Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Just listening to Donna the Buffalo. Donna the Buffalo playing at Lark Hall in Albany tonight. And you can go and find out more information at larkhallalbany.com. Donna the Buffalo tonight at Lark Hall in Albany. You can see the playlist posted online, WAMC.org, WAMC.org/roundtable, and we would love to for you to know what we're playing, and I know a lot of people are interested and care, so that is why that information is available to you. Let me go to introduce our wonderful panel. I also want to just make sure that you know that you can be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll get into a whole bunch of different topics here in just a moment, and you can be a part of those discussions. Publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is in the house. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Joe, good morning. It's nice to see you. It's always great to be here, even though we've now passed the time to talk about the eclipse, something that I cared nothing about. But
did you have anything pithy you wanted to say?
No, that was it. I just sort of felt like I shouldn't have even brought it up because people get mad at me later in the program, and I started right off by getting people mad at me. But I had no interest in the eclipse. I wouldn't have walked across the street. But people who enjoyed it and reveled in it, you know, that's fine. Glad they enjoyed it.
Jimmy Kimmel on his program said, if you missed it, there's something that will be happening tonight called nighttime.
Yeah.
And it'll get dark.
Yeah.
And then the sun will come out.
Well, I was sitting in my living room during the time of totality or whatever it's supposed to be called, and I kept expecting to see out of the corner of my eye nighttime, and we didn't even get that. So.
No. Yeah.
Anyway.
We don't want you in the dark.
No. But I apologize to the many and more listeners than who really enjoyed the event.
Well, it was fun. On Monday's show, we talked a lot about it, and people, you know, were all over the board. A lot of people felt like you felt, and other people were very excited, and we're traveling, and we're going to go see it with their families and make it a bonding opportunity and take the kids and travel and do some fun things. So,
The thing you got to realize about me is I wouldn't walk across the street to watch a fireworks show either. So my tastes are a little bit out of the mainstream.
Yeah, just give you a good sitcom.
a puppet show like Fraggle Rock, Back to the Rock.
Oh my God!
Now on Apple TV Plus.
Ira's son, Matt, is the co-showrunner
yeah.
on that program, and it's in its second season. And I'm about halfway through it, and it's just delightful.
It really is. Although it's a puppet show, it's not just for kids. They talk about
it's
real
Muppets.
Subjects.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Muppets.
Not, yeah, yeah, it's not.
But good, there's good music, and there are some guest stars in there. So
great,
give it a listen.
Yeah, good stuff. It's on Apple TV. Ira, thank you very much. Always good to have you here. Also good to have. I saw Ira twice this week. I get to see Judy twice this week. This is all very nice. Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. So I'm down here also to tape the media project. So I imagine we are going to talk on the media project a little bit, Ira, about the
about
hype.
The eclipse?
And the coverage of the eclipse. So stay tuned.
Right,
Friday,
save some of my
Friday
fire,
at 3. Yes, yeah, stay here.
Again, going back to Jimmy Kimmel, he did a funny bit where he just did this mashup of about 500 news reports of them telling you not to look at the sun.
Put your glasses on.
Yeah,
I heard
and
that a lot.
It was
too.
Very funny. It was very funny. It's just like every newscaster felt compelled to tell you, don't look at the sun.
It just struck me as I was coming. I was up here on Tuesday for a
hold
board meeting.
Fire, Iron.
Well,
hold your
this,
fire, Ira.
I'll separate the media part of it, but I couldn't believe how much traffic that I got stuck in coming home, going down the thruway.
Yeah.
From people who obviously had been upstate or in Canada watching this thing.
Yeah.
The thruway made nice money on the tolls, I guess.
We're Heather Mulligan, the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, should be along shortly, and we'll start in her absence, and I'm sure she will catch up quickly as we move on to the discussion this morning. We talked about this earlier in the week, but I want to bring it back because of, I guess we talked about it yesterday. And that seems so long ago. And the issue is about abortion in the state of Arizona. You will recall that a decision by Arizona's highest court earlier this week upheld an 1864 ban. This is before Arizona was a state. On nearly all abortions, and on nearly all abortions, stop. It created chaos and confusion across the state on Wednesday, as abortion providers were flooded with phone calls from frantic patients. Republican lawmakers of the state capitol, I hate this phrase, you know this, I say this all the time, doubled down and blocked efforts to undo the ban, prompting angry jeers from the Democrats. Democrats who, which I would just like to know, I mean, we'll get into this, but this is very different than the IVF decision in Alabama, where the legislature said, okay, obviously, this isn't good. It's not good for us. It's not good for the party. It's not good for the state. And we will allow legislation to go through to repeal it. That was not the case at all in Arizona. And obviously, IVF and abortion are two different subjects, but there are some similarities as far as the politics. Democrats seized on the decision to resurrect the 160-year-old ban as a pivotal election issue, try to push bills through the Republican-controlled legislature to repeal the ban, a move they said would protect women's health and freedom, and also force Republicans to take a formal vote on the law. But you don't want that. So Republican leaders in the Senate removed one bill from the day's agenda on Wednesday. Legislative aides said that in the House, a Republican lawmaker who had called for striking down the law made a motion to vote on a Democratic repeal bill that has sat stalled for months. But Republican leaders quickly scuttled that effort by calling for a recess and later adjourned until next Wednesday, when I'm sure all of the problems will have gone away. Democrats on the Senate floor yelled shame and save women's lives as the Republican colleagues filed out of the chamber. Judy Patrick.
Wow, wasn't that a stupid decision by the Republicans not to to do something to repeal this legislation? It seems politically stupid. It seems bad for women. It actually politically a good move for Democrats. I mean, they are the good guys in this battle. It's incredible in this day and age that this is happening. And I almost felt sorry for Donald Trump because the day
you're gonna get letters.
Oh, I know. Well, I did, but I don't. Because he the day after he said, let this be a state's decision. Well, the state has decided, and they've decided that abortion should be banned. His reaction, though, however, was saying something along the lines, well, you know, the state's going to fix this. Well, the Republicans in Arizona proved that they're not going to fix it for him, at least not right away. Can I make the point that pregnancy is an issue for women throughout their lives? If you have two or three or more children, your body is affected for the rest of your life. There are issues that people don't like to talk about, you know, bladder leakage and things that women deal with, you know, until they're throughout their lives. So, and women with cancer have problems if they get pregnant. This is not just an issue about having a baby or not having a baby. This is a women's health care issue that is totally being ignored in Arizona. And the political consequences are going to be dramatic. Will the Republicans in Arizona turn around? I think eventually they must, but we'll see.
Right. And they gave themselves until Wednesday. I just don't, you know, how much time do you need? Heather Mulligan is with us, as I mentioned, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press. No, that's wrong.
No,
I'm
wow,
wrong
I got
line.
A new job.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm trying to. I read out of the wrong focal range of my trifocals. CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I blame it on the rain.
Yeah, well, it was bad coming in.
And the eclipse. It messed up my circadian rhythms. And, you know, I know Ira is a huge eclipse fan, so I figured I'd bring it up again.
I'm going to blame everything on the eclipse.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much. Good to have you. Any thoughts on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the outrage at the failure of the Republicans to take up a bill immediately is a little bit misplaced. I mean, they do need time to address this. I think that it's a politically very problematic for them, and I do expect that it's likely, I mean, unless the really far right wing of the party is able to stop it, I do think you're going to see some legislative action there. I think it's very likely. I mean, they could punt and say, we're just going to put it on the ballot and you know, let the voters decide. But I think that would be a mistake, especially when you saw Carrie Lake backing away a little bit from her sort of pro-life, unequivocal pro-life stance and even former President Trump. So, you know, there is an awareness on the part of the party that this issue is very problematic for them, and rightly so. You know, and I'll go back to that the Supreme Court decision made the Republican Party like the dog that caught the car. You know, now what? What do we do? This is not helping. So,
Ira.
Well, unlike Judy, I don't feel any sympathy for Donald Trump on this.
I said I almost.
Wow, did I miss something?
Almost.
She's not sending him notes or anything.
Here's a guy who thought he could split the baby, no pun intended, by taking credit for the demise of Roe v. Wade, and very, very directly doing that in a clip that we're going to see for the next 6-8 months. At the same time, he saying this is a state's decision. And then at the same time that it's a state's decision, when Arizona does what it thinks it should be doing, he and the outcry is significant, and in Trump's case, negatively significant. He's not trying to dance back and say, well, we'll take care of that. Well, wait a minute. It's supposed to be a state's decision. So he's all over the map. They're all over the map. And, you know, I don't have a very accurate crystal ball, but I would like to think that for all of the discussion about how this election is going to turn out and how the economy is going to be the issue or how immigration is going to be the issue or how the war in Gaza is going to be the issue, the end of the day that this abortion issue is going to be it, because women and predominantly women, but many men as well, are going to come out and say, wait a minute. Don't mess with this abortion business. This is what the people want. And if you don't want an abortion, you know, fine, don't get one. But don't prevent me from getting one.
I agree with you, Heather, in the sense that, you know, we'll see what the legislature does. But it still seems like they played it very poorly. They could have given a good, for want of a better term, BS answer. To give by themselves some time, but it does seem, you know, just by doing what they did, that they were supporting the court decision.
Yeah, I don't think they do support the court decision necessarily. I think they were surprised by it. Often when people are surprised, they don't necessarily make the best political decisions. but I do think, I mean, I'll say this, I've said it before, that had Roe v. Wade not been decided as it was, I think that this would be a settled issue. I think every state would have legal access to abortion up to some degree. I mean, the fact that even in Ireland, you know, this is something that people want. They want access to abortion care. And I do think that what happened with Roe v. Wade is the issue got taken off the table at the state level for so long that people were comfortable staking out positions that weren't reflective necessarily of what most people's views are. And I think that's true on both sides. I mean, I think there were folks who were, you know, far more, there needs to be access at every stage at any cost. And I think if you did some polling, you'd find out that most people aren't there. They're kind of more in the middle. But all that being said, I think we'll get there. I think it's one of those issues where people feel safe that they're not going to be forced to make a vote on something. They take a position that might not necessarily be their real position if it was something they had to decide on. And again, you know, that's what happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
We'll take a break. We'll continue the conversation right after. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're talking about the Arizona abortion ban and the Republicans looking to thwart the thwarting the attempts by Democrats to repeal the 1864 abortion ban. I think isn't that the topic, that part of the story that I think is resonating with so many people, is that we're talking about legislation that was drafted in 1864.
Before Arizona was a state.
Correct.
When the territory had 8,000 or 9,000 people, women couldn't vote. Although that's when they, you know, the Constitution was enacted back in the 18th century. So
I think it's a little bit of a red herring, right? I mean, a law, as long as it's on the books, it's still a law.
Old laws are.
I mean,
still
it doesn't
laws.
Mean it's a good law. And there's a lot of stupid laws on the books that haven't been repealed, but. There's not many people sitting around looking, reading old laws to go, is this still relevant? Should we get rid of it?
But it wasn't being enforced.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And the Republicans in Arizona have had plenty of time to look at this law because it's been under debate since the Dobbs decision. I mean, it's not like this was sprung upon them at the last minute. They knew this was a potential for coming. And so that's why I've feel they should have taken some action yesterday or shown some, given some signal that they were going to seriously consider repealing it.
Well, what also wasn't a good look, I mean, in terms of the atmosphere in Arizona, is that the legislative body, the speaker or whatever, or the president of the council there, called for a vote, and it was a voice vote, and the Republicans were all one way, and then all opposed, and there was this outcry of voices, and he said, "Okay, we're going." And I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but it just looked like the goose. He just rushed the whole thing away instead of listening to the other side.
Well, that's what I was saying to Heather earlier. I mean, it seems like they could have come up with some response that would have at least indicated that they're going to. Well, figure out what to do other than kicking it down just to win.
Well, in the House, when they take a voice vote, if there sounds like there's some opposition, they then do an individual vote. I mean, that's what democracy is all about. But
that's what they didn't want. That
they didn't want that.
Right. And as far as how this plays in national politics, I mean, the most interesting part of it is. What Judy was referencing earlier of how it affects Trump's message and the Republican message, because this has gummed up the works. It hasn't helped I said this earlier in the week, but the New York Times headline about the statement that Trump made clarifying his position on abortion says, after months of mixed signals and misdirection. You know, and the second part of that should have been he issued a statement with more misdirection and mixed signals.
Well, so. It's 9:37. He'll change his mind in about another half hour. Whatever he said yesterday has no meaning to what he might say today or tomorrow.
I think with him, the real question is, what do we think he would do if Congress presented him with legislation banning abortion nationally? Would he stand by his view that it's a states' rights issue, or would he sign the bill? I think he'd sign the bill.
Right. He would say that Congress is the people.
Right.
They are
they
elected Congress, so he's going to let the people decide, and Congress has decided to do this, so he would sign it. I think throughout his anything he said on abortion, he will say, well, we'll let the people decide. And that gives him cover for anything. It gives him cover if a legislature passes it. It gives him, maybe he could use a poll. I mean, it's a all around good way to get what he wants.
Did you watch the full statement? Did anybody see the full statement? No. I mean, it was when he starts going off about the post birth executions.
Well,
I mean, my Lord, it's wacky town, and you know, into years of their life, what? I don't know. It's a very strange thing to watch.
So doesn't that get to? I mean, there's this whole debate going on right now about whether or not there should be more coverage of him, because you know there was a huge push to say he's getting too much airtime. Now he's off Twitter. Now he's really not, you know, on any of the networks that as frequently. And I think what happens then if he's off the air is you forget how kind of outlandish some of the things he says are. You know, this is the guy who tried to buy Greenland, right? As it's like,
right.
And I think that, you know, the kind of the craziness and those kinds of statements, they're not right in people's, you know, immediate memory. And that is going to have an impact on you know, positive or negative views.
I direct this to Judy Patrick because she was one of the panel members that we've had who, rightfully so, I think has said that the Democrats and particularly the Biden campaign have been very bad in messaging and sort of seizing on these moments. It seems, however, in the last several weeks that they're taking these comments, they're putting out videos, they're putting out reels, they're putting commercials out, and they're taking these statements and then they have Biden responding. I don't know how, you know, if they're working or not. But it does seem to certainly be a much more aggressive approach than we had seen prior.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. One of the this has been a real struggle for the news media. In some respects, they're just taking the most salient points or what they consider the most newsworthy points and focusing on that as they write the story and not the whole crazy speech. I mean, it was just a week or so ago, I think, that Trump was suggesting that Joe Biden was on cocaine when he gave the State of the Union address.
Hugh Hewitt, and that he would he was talking to Hugh Hewitt, and said that, yes, he was on something and that he would not do a debate. And we have an item on our docket today about debates, so we may get into this. But regarding that, he would not debate Biden until he took a drug test because he didn't want to take to debate him if he was on coke.
You know, Joe Biden should have demanded a COVID test before he debated Donald Trump back then, when Donald Trump had COVID and debated him anyway.
And I will admit that I had forgotten. You know, there's so much stuff that comes out of these stories that it's kind of hard to remember everything. But there was they found the baggie of coke in the security area,
right,
of entering the White House. And I guess that's where it comes from, that obviously it could not have been belonging to any of the staff or the visitors, that it was obviously that of the president.
And he uses the same technique that he used with suggesting, Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S. He's like, oh, I'm just asking the question. I mean, you're not just asking the question. But in reference to your original question, sure, I think that the Democrats have finally woken up and realized they've got to fight back and be aggressive, and they have some smart people doing some smart things. It's targeted, I think, a lot on social media, but it's smart to fight back. You can't just sit back and take.
Yes.
So I think Saturday Night Live suggested that President Biden was on Celsius when he gave his address, which I, by the way, am a huge fan of Celsius. Anyone who likes an energy drink, it's got a list of vitamins on the back, so it makes you feel like it's really good for you, you know. But it's like 200 milligrams of caffeine.
And we know that former President Trump likes his Coca-Cola, or Diet Coke.
Yeah,
that has really worked well for
him. Well, I think, you know, go back to one of the original point I think that Heather was making is, in terms of the media coverage. I think that generally speaking, the coverage has been much more measured than his past two runs for president. I'm sticking with the cable now. I'm not talking about print, but other than the far right channels, Fox and farther right than Fox, they're not going as live to his events as often as they used to. The other channels are fact checking in real time. So I believe in general the media is doing a better job covering him, and the fact is, as much as many of us don't like it, the man is the nominee for the Republican Party. So there is an obligation on our part to cover him, and we got to let the voters know what it is this man represents, as hard as it is to figure out what he represents sometime. But, you know, the when he ran against Hillary, he had free rein. He was networks put him on because he was entertaining as much as anything else. And now that his danger has been exposed and his inaccuracies have been highlighted, we're seeing again, I go back to the phrase, a more measured approach in how he's being covered.
Yeah, I agree. My comment mostly reflected there's been on the part of Democratic strategists some suggestion that there needs to be more coverage of him now, which is a complete opposite of what their view was sort of historically. But I think there's a recognition that if you see more of someone on TV or I guess on cable or on YouTube or whatever, someone you see more frequently there's a tendency for the negatives to be emphasized more than someone you don't see at all. And that was sort of the way it was at least presented on some, you know, satellite news conversation that I listened to.
Yeah, I don't think any of us understand nor fully accept how much influence the social media end of it has.
Yeah.
If you're looking to say that you know, Biden did coke, there's plenty of places that you can find that will state that as fact, mm-hmm. and people believe it. And I'm not sure how we as a nation or the world is going to come to grips with the free rein that social media has. I mean, I think even those of us who are from the traditional media don't want to block First Amendment issues. But I'm not sure how that's going to sort itself out. But I believe it's there's more downside right now than upside to the social media programs.
Well, especially with the algorithms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if kids are getting most of their news from TikTok and what they watch is based on an algorithm of what they watched before, I mean, you're going to end up with, you know, sort of a very like drastically limited set of facts, and a lot of them might not even be facts.
Yeah. And I agree with Judy and Joe that I think the messaging has improved on the Biden campaign. Although I think they're going to be very careful to not use Biden in his own commercials, except for this message was approved by, because it just never know when he's going to trip up. It's a minor point, but yesterday during his news conference, he talked about being part of the 20th century. He immediately caught himself to the 21st century, but you can just see that the Fox News crowd would jump on something like that.
Let's hold it there. We have letters on the abortion issue in Arizona. I want to get to those. And we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. And we'll be right back after this.
You'll be flying high as a kite when the wind gets blowing. You'll be right back where you started.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So nice to have you. We have been talking about the abortion decision. It was the court decision in Arizona that ultimately upheld an 1864 ban on nearly all abortions. Then the legislature, certainly Democrats in the legislature, tried to repeal that, and the Republican-controlled legislature moved in the direction to not do that and to shut the Democrats down. So with that in mind, we go to our letters for today. John says state laws should apply to things that are unique to each state. Abortion, as well as all health care, is a concern that crosses all state lines and should be a uniform law that covers the entire United States of America.
I mean, every state has different rules about driver's licenses, about how we vote. And I mean, that's not what the Constitution and the deal made with the states was that they get to control things that are not clearly spelled out as the federal government's responsibility. That's what the whole battle between states and federal government is. There's always been tension, but anything not enumerated is reserved to the states.
Richard writes, how ironic is it that more than 165 years after the Dred Scott decision, the rallying cry of states' rights is being invoked by those who would deprive their fellow citizens of the right to bodily autonomy. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. That from Richard. We go to Adrian. Is it even worth parsing out Trump's stated position on an issue, given that he is not beholden to any standard of truth? Whatever he says pre-election will be meaningless post-election if he wins. Well, we talked a lot about that yesterday, and I think certainly admitted it today, but it's hard to know, and it's a good point.
You know, that being said, it's difficult with every politician to hold them to a campaign promise. But with Donald Trump, it has been especially egregious. I mean, I've seen politicians will get into office and they won't be able to fulfill a campaign promise. But it's far more rational, far more measured, and far more understandable than Donald Trump. It's just simple lies.
Let's go to Mitchell, who says, just tell us the Republican plan to fix all the problems they say Democrats caused and can't fix. All right.
Well, they can't. They can identify problems very well when they're the out party, but they don't know how to fix it, or they haven't demonstrated they can fix it.
Let me go to Florence. Problematic for the Republicans, dare I say, it is problematic for women and their health care, to say nothing about the negative effect on the economy. Yes, there are a lot of collateral in all of these, and certainly that is the main point of it being problematic for women. But we're looking at it in this lens of a legislative and political body.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that it's not problematic for women. I was suggesting, I think, and I don't, maybe I wasn't clear, but that, you know, when you stake out a position on something where you don't think there's any risk of having to live up to it, that's a lot different than when all of a sudden, you know, you actually have to cast a vote on that issue. And that is, you know, that's what happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, is all of a sudden people who were staunch pro-life now actually have to cast a vote, you know, laying out their position. And that is not where the majority of people are in this country. And so they risk losing office. And that is what happened in the midterm. And, you know, that's the consequence of staking out a position that you think is safe when it's actually not.
And in the meantime, the Arizona Attorney General and the governor of Arizona have come out and said that they have no intention of prosecuting anyone who has an abortion in the meantime until something is done about this decision. So they've said that, and I believe them. But if you're a woman of childbearing age, or if you're a doctor who tends to women of childbearing age, it certainly has to be a very tough time until things get resolved. I heard someone on Fox saying, well, you know, women can just take a bus to another state. Well, that's not why should the women of Arizona have fewer rights than the women of the state for at a 4-hour bus ride away?
What do you think is a matter of principle when what you just described, the attorney general and the governor saying they're not going to uphold, not going to prosecute? Let's put aside this particular issue and let's pick another one. What do we think of that?
I know. I agree. It's you have seen sheriffs in New York State say they won't enforce certain laws that they disagree with. I mean, the idea of an attorney general saying, no, I'm not going to enforce that law, she has gone on the record as saying, well, it's because I'm waiting for the people to decide. I think there's a ballot measure in November on abortion access. And so she's waiting for that.
But it violates her oath. I mean, it's a clear violation of the oath, because any attorney general or governor swears to uphold the laws of the state that they're serving.
Her position is that the decision violates the state constitution.
And if that's the case, then the court is wrong. I mean, right. You know, so... It's whatever the law is.
And this decision is not appealable to the Supreme Court, correct?
I doubt it. It's a matter of state law. Right. So and now it's a non-constitutional issue. So and going back to what I said before, you know, I said if Congress were to pass a bill banning abortion nationally, I actually think there will be a constitutional challenge to that because the Supreme Court has already said clearly this is a state's issue.
Get to a couple more letters before we take a break at the top of the hour. Mary says many women need an abortion. It isn't just something they want. From teens who need an abortion to prevent a lifetime of socioeconomic hardship to those who already have as many children as they can house and feed to those who have a serious pregnancy complication but aren't on death's doorstep immediately. I could go on and on. Women need to be trusted to make the decision they need. They need appropriate health care. That from Mary. We go to Erica. Since Roe was overturned, abortions have not decreased. Birth rates have not increased. And more women have long-term health problems such as infertility and even death. Regardless of the pro-lifer's moral or faith stance, what is the actual outcome they want? Is this about abstaining from sex? Is this about marriage? None of the things that they want are happening. So what exactly do they want? And I hate when the answer is Republicans hate women. I don't think that is correct.
Yeah, what do they want? It's hard to get away from the wonderful image of a mother and a baby, and a lot of people are caught up with that. It's almost a myth. But I think in some respects it's about control. It's about this is how I want society to be, and it gets wrapped up. You know, it wasn't always an issue. Abortion wasn't an issue so much in the 50s and 60s, and at least not such a political issue. I think some people on the right have found this is a powerful issue to get elected, and so.
But it wasn't out in the open in the 50s. I mean, it seems to me there always have been abortions,
sure.
But the way they were conducted was in the back alleys. So it's always been an issue. It just started to come about in the 50s and 60s.
I think there is a group of people who legitimately, religiously believe that life begins at conception and that abortion is the ending of a life without justification, right? I'm not saying that's my position. I want to be clear. But I do think that there are people who very strongly have religious beliefs and I respect those beliefs, but I don't think that gives them the right to dictate what happens to people, especially, you know, prior to a fetus being viable. I think that is not something that one subset of people should have the right to determine for everyone else.
It seemed like it was a secondary political issue throughout the 80s. It was always an issue. We were talking about the flood of letters to the editors we used to get when we were at newspapers. But in the last 10, 15 years, it has become a ferocious political issue.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that is because people have found it to be a very good way to get people to the polls and to get elected.
Two letters, and then we'll go to a break. We have this one from Susan. If you want to learn more about the seemingly unfathomable Republican religious rights need to fight to control women's bodies, please read Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work by Jenny Brown. You'll learn about how women are a cog in the wheel of work, immigration, birth rates, pregnancy or not, and capitalism. The book offers a lot of new learning for me. And finally, Anthony, making excuses for the Arizona Republicans is kind of creepy. The majority of Arizonians and Americans are in favor of access to abortion. Republicans have miscalculated the power of women. They will pay for that mistake at the polls in November. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel, Heather Mulligan, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Heather Mulligan, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, joins us. Publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is here. And Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, joins us as well. I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I slightly teased this earlier in our discussion about debates, and I thought we could talk about this. TV networks are looking to urge both Biden and Trump to debate. And as the headline in the New York Times says, wading into a fraught topic, speculation has swirled in the political world about whether the presumptive candidates will agree to the traditional face-to-face events, a campaign staple since 1976. In an unusual move, the five major broadcast and cable news networks have prepared a joint open letter that urges President Biden and former President Donald Trump to participate in televised debates ahead of Election Day, according to two people with direct knowledge of their plans. The letter, endorsed by ABC, CBS, CNN, NBC, and Fox News, thrusts into public view a question that has swirled within media and political circles: whether the presidential debates, one of the nation's last remaining mass civic rituals in a polarized age, will occur at all this year. We, the undersigned national news organizations, urge the presumptive presidential nominees to publicly commit to participating in general election debates before November's election, according to the letter, which was obtained, the draft of that letter was obtained by the New York Times. The letter is not yet final, and the networks are also seeking endorsements from other leading national news organizations, including newspapers. Mr. Biden has repeatedly declined to comment to participating in the three debates scheduled for September and October. His aides say they are concerned that the Commission on Presidential Debates, the nonpartisan group that has organized the debates since 1988, will be unable to enforce the rules when Mr. Trump takes the stage. Mr. Trump has vowed to debate and has taken to taunting Mr. Biden for not following suit. But Mr. Trump's track record is mixed. In 2020, he pulled out of a debate against Mr. Biden at the last minute, prompting its cancellation. And in the recent Republican primary, he refused to appear on stage even once with his opponents. I'm also, I believe it was Ronna McDaniel, when heading the RNC, said that they didn't want to be a part of presidential debates looking into this season. So
they, meaning Trump.
Meaning Republican candidates, including Trump. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Trump called the shots.
Yeah. Yes, which is why she's out of work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you finished with the setup? Yeah. I just think that I could get behind them having debates, but only if two conditions are met that would satisfy me. One is there'd be no studio audience, and two is that they would have, and the candidates would know ahead of time, the moderators would have the ability to shut off a microphone if one candidate does what Trump historically has done. Otherwise, as you know, I'm not a big fan of these debates. I think they're a waste of time. They become partisan showcases, and don't break any new ground as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with Ira. Count me as one of the people who hopes they don't have debates, because they're sideshows. They don't convey any real information. The idea that you're going to be able to control either candidate is just far-fetched. Candidates go on and on. If you cut them off, you're considered rude. The questions are usually long-winded, not to the point, and it becomes just theater where people judge how quickly they answer. I can't get over the image of Donald Trump hovering over Hillary Clinton in that 2016 debate. And for 10 years or so, I've hated the debates. I just don't think that they're cogent. I don't think that they convey. I wish that we could have like a real debate like they have in law schools. That would be
fascinating. There was nothing wrong with the JFK Nixon debates.
As you remember, the key takeaway from the Nixon Kennedy debates was the fact that Nixon needed better makeup.
Right, but if you listened on the radio, people thought Nixon won the debate if you only heard it and didn't watch it. But they were in a studio, each had a lectern, or they sat in between, and they talked about the issues. There was no cheering, partisan cheering.
Well, this is to your point too, is about the cheering. But I mean, there was a time not that long ago. Well, maybe it was a long time ago. I don't know. But when Jim Lehrer was the guy who did all the debates, and they were in these very sterile academic environments, and God help you if you made a noise, like they you were gone, like they were, yeah, I mean, you were out of there. And that is not the case anymore. And I mean, obviously, I think some of it is a byproduct of our polarization in our politics, but also, you know, I don't know if we can have those kind of debates anymore, where you have two candidates who are going to agree to stand behind a lectern and talk about only the things that they're being asked about without a sideshow happening in the audience.
I mean, I think you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of a debate, right? When you don't have social media and you don't have known very, you know, thoroughly covered candidates, that's one thing. But we know where they stand on the issues, at least, you know, what they've said. and that only really applies to one of them. But this is, what is the purpose? Is the purpose to find a recordable moment to then put in an ad to embarrass them and have that be the rationale for people voting or not voting? I don't think that there's anything real that can come out of a debate that would take people out of undecided and put them into, okay, that's the guy I'm going to vote for because he said X, Y, and Z. I just think that day has come and gone. We've got, you know, so much coverage between cable and social media, and that there's not a whole lot of unknowns here. So what do we accomplish from the debate other than, you know, creating an opportunity? Well, plus the, you know, the ratings, right? I guess that's part of why they want to have the debate, is people do still somewhat watch them.
Relevant, continue right. to be relevant when a time when they are increasingly irrelevant.
Right, right.
Well, I think that there is a potential for the debates to be valuable if under the right conditions. I mean, if you have two guys up there or two women or whatever the mix is going to be, and the moderator, let's say, introduces a question about immigration, and candidate A discusses his point, his position on immigration, and candidate B does the same, and then maybe they talk back to each other, not nastily so, but in a debate in the true sense of the word that they teach in debating school, that's fine. But the problem is, as you suggest, it's gotten away from that. Decorum has the peanut gallery effect is significant and influential, I believe. And they don't follow the rules. So right. It's got to be under the right conditions.
Also, I mean, we are so polarized. Who are you going to get? We don't have a Jim Lehrer type anymore. We don't have someone who is right down, you know, that we don't think of as a liberal or a conservative journalist. Who would you put in? I mean, if
Colin Powell,
Joe Donahue, yeah,
Colin Powell, that would be a tough one.
Yeah, you know,
he's not currently available.
I know.
I mean, I would say Lester Holt could certainly do mm-hmm. it. I would say that Christiane Amanpour could do it. I think there are people out there, but whether, you know, again, to your point about ratings, I don't know that would necessarily work. But it is, you know, you see the primary debates, and you have in the last election cycle, it was, you know, Megyn Kelly
and Chris Cuomo.
I mean, right. I mean, it becomes a showcase for them as well. And I think that again shows, you know, how they've changed, where you can find somebody who can come in and do a really good job.
Well, the debate commission, and I'm going to forget the names, but there's a Democrat who is the representative, used to be a White House press secretary. I want to say his first name is Mike, and I can't remember his second name.
McCarthy?
No. But at any rate, so you have him, and then you have his counterpart on the Republican side. If you're a nerd like I occasionally am and watch the debates on C-SPAN, where you see what those two people do prior to the debate beginning in terms of the admonitions, et cetera, I mean, those two people would be, to your point, appropriate to moderate the debates. They're agreed upon as neutral and can advance these things. But, you know, Lester Holt and Christiane Amanpour would immediately spark cries of liberalism on the part of the right. And if you took, I don't know, Bret Baier, you'd get the opposite. So you're right. I don't know who you would call.
Well, I think maybe not a face-to-face back-and-forth debate. I don't think that's ever going to be constructive at this point. I think a one-on-one interview between a good, solid reporter, print, broadcast, whatever, between each candidate, asking them the same questions and airing that without editing it. Or, well, maybe in Donald Trump's case, well, maybe
Trump
you do need to edit or add some
that.
Stuff.
And he'll, you know, excuse me. You know.
But, you know, Jonathan Swan did a great interview with Trump back in the day where you could see him really try to nail him down on certain issues. And I think one-on-one debates between a real serious reporter and a candidate for the highest office in the land aired nationally would be instructive.
You've seen things like that, though, even with when Trump went up against Leslie Stahl and he just gets up and walks away.
Right.
Yeah. So that's another part of it. The other concern, I think, is probably maybe just an overall concern about democracy. But I think if you move away on presidential debates, I hope it doesn't mean you also move away from local debates and regional debates, because I do think those are helpful.
But the same rules need to apply. There can't be distractions. There can't be cheerleading. And you have to be able to cut somebody off if they're using too much time or going in the wrong direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I do think they serve a purpose for the audience. And are in elections where there's candidates that just are not as known and their positions are not as known,
right,
that these debates, you know, mostly done by the League of Women Voters and other organizations, are really helpful for people to come in and find out who's going to represent them in a town election, a village election, a county election, a state election.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that you get a chance to ask the second question, right? Like your position on immigration is what? And then the next question is, and how would that work? You know, how would you implement it? How would you get the legislature to do what you need them to do in order to move these policies forward? I mean, you can put together a platform that sounds good on paper, and if the person doesn't have, you know, the next level of understanding of how to implement these things, it's good to know that before they're in office.
And issues that also are directly that are things that the candidate will actually be able to act upon.
Right.
Instead of overall political theory of how you feel about certain issues, as opposed to how are you going to represent the people of the state, the county, the town, and on things that they have that they're going to be voting on and working with.
I think the presidential debates hit a low spot for me when, I don't know which election it was, but the candidates were asked whether it was boxers or briefs. Remember that?
Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
They had an MTV.
That was an MTV. That was Kurt Loder.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an audience question.
Rock
the vote.
I like to see politicians think on their feet. And what they do with these presidential debates now is they spend a week or 10 days just prepping canned answers to whatever, you know, we know you're going to be asked this, here's the canned answer. Or when your opponent says this is what you say, and it's more like memorized lines, except in the case of Donald Trump, who will go off on a riff. I mean, but the problem is, if Biden says he's not going to debate, this is going to be one of the things that Trump uses as a campaign tactic for the next 6 months. He's already trotted out the empty podium and saying, yep, this is where Joe Biden should be, but he's not. He's afraid to debate me.
But he's got to be careful how far he pushes that, because he didn't show up at any of the Republican debates.
The hypocrisy, you think that's an issue for him?
No, only a little bit.
There was a 1 hour and 43 minute debate between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, and the only thing I can tell you about the debate was the fly.
The fly.
Oh, yeah.
The fly.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't remember anything else about that debate.
And there was another debate, I think in the same election cycle. It was where one of the women had her hair had a lot of hairspray on it, and there was a lot of talk about that.
Yeah.
That's what.
Well, there was always those moments. I mean, this has gone on forever. Who looked at their watch?
Yeah, there's the water bottle. There's the watch. There's.
They said the elder George Bush had a. A device in his ear and was getting information, intel. There have been all kinds of crazy things that have come up as a result of these debates. I'll miss those. Okay, so let's go to a couple letters on the debates, actually. Melinda says, a total waste of time for anyone to debate Trump. He doesn't debate. He just rants and raves about witch hunts and injustices to him. No moderator would be able to keep him contained within the guidelines. I think that's true. I don't know of a moderator who would be able to contain him. You saw this even with Hugh Hewitt the other day, where that wasn't a debate, but it was an interview. And here is a guy who is a conservative broadcaster, and he was befuddled as to getting answers, straight answers. And I don't know that anyone can do that. So agree with the letter writer on that. We go to Carol. Until the moderators figure out how to combat falsehoods on the spot, I don't need a presidential debate. Well, that's hard too, isn't it?
You just have to have subtitles. Checking. Not true.
And part of the problem is the fact that it's a former president, and the moderators give him a certain amount of respect, as probably is his due, and that colors what happens as well. As you know, it's hard to interrupt. It's hard to say. You know, to assert yourself in an interview. Everybody interviews differently, as you know. You teach a course on this,
yes.
And there are different tactics for it. But that would be a good thing for your, give a final exam to your class. Say, how would you interview President Trump?
It's a great point. And we have an interesting letter, too. I mean, one of the problems that the debate commission has dealt with for going back to, I believe, the 1980 campaign. I said they went into business, what did I say, 76? So it would have been the 80 campaign when John Anderson ran against Carter and Reagan. And there, that question was, should he be part of the debates? He wasn't. And then we've gone through this with Ralph Nader. We've gone through this with Perot. We've gone through this throughout many election cycles of third candidates should be part. Should the Green Party candidate be a part of the debates? And now the question of one of our listeners, Jan, writes, okay, what about RFK Jr.? Do you put RFK Jr. in the debate? And the commission has always had and certainly in the localized debates too, have been looking at poll numbers and are they viable candidates, and that's how they've made their decision. I don't know how you work on that now.
I think that's the way you have to determine. There needs to be a determination by the sponsors of the debates as to whether or not a third party person has got a legitimate reason to be there. Otherwise, you're wasting our time. I still haven't found the Democrat, but Frank Ferenkoff, who was the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, is one of the leaders of the Commission on Debates. And I'm going to find his current counterparts are Dorothy Ridings, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Council on Foundations, and Kenneth Wallach, former president of the National Democratic Institute. And though that would be who I would start looking for as debate moderators. I'm going to try to find the Democrat that I was referencing, Mike.
In some respects, though, when you get a famous broadcaster, it adds a little star power to the debate, and that becomes part of the story as well. And it's something for their resume as well. I moderated this debate. I don't know. Sometimes people tune in to see how the moderator does. That's part of it.
I liked it when it was just Jim Lehrer because he was the only one who did it for five election cycles. So thoughts.
Maybe AI can recreate him.
Thoughts. AI debate.
Thoughts from the audience. Fred says, "How about Margaret Hoover? I've seen her do a great job of maintaining control. That is a fine example." And Allie says, "Here you go, Money in the Bank. Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow." Well, we don't want them debating each other. We want the candidates debating, right?
I think that would be unwatchable. I think it would make everyone mad and they change the channel.
Bill writes, "Not seriously suggesting this, but there is one person who as moderator could handle Trump, and that is Howard Stern. Not a great idea, but fun to picture. Sad that's where we're at in American presidential
politics." Who's going to keep telling? Baba Booey?
Baba Booey. That's absolutely right. Fred can do drops. It'll be great. It's an interesting, we'll see what happens. But it seems like we always have this back and forth and we always end up with something, right? There's always just one.
You know, Donald Trump began, in his early years, he was heavily involved in wrestling, you know.
Yes.
And it seems like these debates have become much like a pro or WWE wrestling match.
Which is all real.
It's all real.
Yeah, it's all real.
We're going to have, scantily clad women walking across the stage holding the timer. You just watch.
I have an interview about wrestler Randy Savage coming up later in the program. not to give a forward promotion for the program. All right, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll finish up the conversation for this Thursday morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Limited time, so please keep them short and to the point, and that way we can get in as many as possible. We have a few more topics to discuss before we call it a panel on this Thursday morning. We will return and welcome your letters after this short break in news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Heather Mulligan, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick make up the group, and we welcome you. Panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org.
And just so I don't leave the listeners hanging, Mike McCurry was the name I was reaching for, former White House press secretary.
That's correct. All right. Let's go to another topic here, and as long as this website lets me log in, we're good. Some January 6th rioters win early release even before key Supreme Court ruling. This is from the Washington Post. Federal judges have begun ordering the early release pending appeal of January 6th defendants who challenged their sentences, even though the Supreme Court is a week away from hearing arguments on whether a key charge brought against them is legally sound. A Delaware man who carried a Confederate flag into the Capitol will be let go 1 year into his 3-year term. An Ohio man who overran police lines and became one of the first rioters to enter the Capitol will be set free 6 months into a 19-month term. And a man who centered the just-evacuated Senate chamber with a Trump flag as a cape was released after serving 5 months of a 14-month term. If the Supreme Court ultimately determines the charge they faced was legitimate, they and others who are released early pending appeal could be ordered to return to prison, but that is not a certainty. The truncated sentences are the latest complication in the prosecution of more than 350 January 6th defendants under a federal statute that makes it a crime to obstruct or impede an official proceeding. In this case, Congress's joint session to confirm Joe Biden's 2020 presidential victory. In December, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a consolidated challenge by three men whose lawyers argue that the law passed by the Congress is limited to destroying evidence in governmental investigations. That from the Washington Post. Let's start with the lawyer.
So I understand why they would do this, because being incarcerated, whether or not you like what the person did, I mean, that is very serious. It's not a small thing to lock somebody up and put them in jail. If the underlying charge is found to be invalid, then they would have served time wrongfully. Whether or not you agree with what they did or think that they're awful people, if the underlying charge is not valid, then they should be, they're doing the right thing by letting them go until that determination is made. Some of these sentences for folks who did not commit acts of violence are fairly long. So I'm not justifying anything they did. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying if there is something wrong, an infirmity in the conviction, and the argument is that this particular statute that they were convicted under relates to the destruction of evidence, and they did not destroy evidence. And it goes back to the Enron case and the shredding of paper and all of that, rather than trying to stop the certification, which is the legal theory that they were convicted under. If this statute doesn't apply, then they would ultimately be released. And it is, I think not unusual to say, well, if they're serving their sentence right now and there's a chance that the statute might be overturned, and it sounds like there's a very big chance that the convictions might be overturned, then it's not the right thing to continue to incarcerate them.
Right. Typically people, well, not typically, there are cases where people will remain free pending appeals. It
right.
happens all the time locally.
But it's usually people with financial resources that a lot of these guys don't have any.
True. I thought it was unusual that they were in prison or jail and were released pending this. This would have big implications for a lot of people. It just seems like there should be, it's just as my common sense is telling me, what they did was obstructing the certification of Joe Biden's election. Even though they weren't, poking people with flags, were defecating in the hallways, the mass of them effectively let other people do that. So from a layman's perspective, it's disheartening. I understand the being released pending the appeal. But if the charge doesn't hold, if there's no other charge against them, maybe public nuisance or
those are misdemeanors.
Misdemeanors.
And I think the vast majority of these folks, they're being released for times that would exceed or sentences that would exceed a misdemeanor.
A misdemeanor is typically a year.
The maximum is a year. Usually, you don't ever serve that. It would be probably 6 months. Realistically, we don't hold people on misdemeanors for the full year.
So it's just a misdemeanor to go in mass into the state, into the capital of the United States, and disrupt the proceedings, potentially aiding people who want to stop the election of a president. And there's no law against that.
But remember, criminal law, we are talking about the consequence of incarceration. You really do need intent, right? You need to show, and there's definitely recklessness. There's other elements that aren't always specific intent. If the consequence was, for example, that it wasn't certified, and some of the folks that were there because, they're rowdy and they're big partiers and they're a bunch of jerks, is it right to use our prison system to incarcerate them for extended periods of time? And I think, you know, if the law is not valid or the conviction is not valid, the right thing to do is to release them.
And we are a nation of laws.
Yes.
Well, let's just clarify for me. The judge or judges who made the or are making the decisions to let these people go for the time being, was that as a result of appeals by the perpetrators?
You know,
or did they take it upon he or she take it upon themselves to do this?
I don't know the answer to that. But it would be the sentencing judge, I think, that would have the jurisdiction to do that. And they might retain that jurisdiction if there's appeals pending, for example. And I'm guessing there are appeals pending on most of these.
Well, I don't know. I don't want – we are a nation of laws, and if the law is nothing not kosher is going on here, then fine. But I was impressed by the fact that the court did, in fact, find so many of these people guilty and sentence them accordingly. And it concerns me a bit that this is turning around, and unless the foundation is such that it would be a miscarriage of justice to not – do this, but as was pointed out in the setup to the story, there is a immunity case coming up, and should a lower court have interfered at this point in time when we're waiting for a further judgment?
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't impact immunity. The sentence is relating. There's no. I mean, I think the issue here is really whether or not the conviction under this statute is you know legally founded.
Yeah.
Like, can you say that this was an appropriate statute under which to convict them? It doesn't mean that they didn't do anything wrong. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the presidential immunity issue, which that whole thing is a big mess, right? So
yeah, immunity was a bad choice of words.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, there's lots and lots of examples where statutes have been ruled, you know, void for vagueness or not the appropriate statute under which an individual was convicted. And it is the right thing to do to reverse those convictions. And it's wrong to continue to incarcerate someone under a statute that was not the appropriate statute, right? That doesn't mean you can't, you know, find the right statute. Or maybe what they did really just was a misdemeanor, in which case giving them 4 years in prison isn't the appropriate sentence.
It's the Justice Department that determined that they were going to prosecute under this law.
And so the Justice Department has a very sketchy track record as far as the validity of convictions that they've secured. I mean, New York is a great example of that. We've had so many convictions reversed under the theft of honest services statute. How many of those have been reversed now? Like the vast majority of them. The Justice Department is a prosecutorial agency, and they take the statutes at face value and they try and secure convictions. But they're not doing a hard look at whether or not this is something that is, you know, constitutional or whether or not the cases necessarily meet the criteria. And I'm painting a broad brush. I'm not saying the whole Justice Department, but they do not always have the best track record.
But correct me if I'm wrong here. If Donald Trump if there isn't a charges and a trial on that, and they're letting people, and pending the court decision, but they're letting people out, then you can get away with it, right?
We'll get away with what?
Storming the Capitol.
An insurrection in the Capitol of the United States to try to circumvent democracy.
Well, I mean, charge them with riot. Charge them with, you know, whatever other things you can charge them with. It doesn't mean you can get away with it. But it does mean that the statute under which they were charged and convicted may not have been the appropriate one.
I understand. Yes, I understand. I guess I'm just. It seems that we're on the slippery slope now. That as time goes on, the things are crumbling, and you just wonder. You know, you think of that day, and you say, "Well,
that seemed illegal,
right? That seems like something's going to happen,
right?
Like, oh, yeah. this seems really bad,
yeah."
And yet, the consequences are scarce.
Well, I don't know that they're nothing, and the anyone who was charged with violence or assault, that they are not being released if they were charged with violence or assault. But you need to have a set of rules, and apply them in a way that is fair and even-handed. And if they were charged with the wrong thing, I mean, take it, like, let's say they were charged with, I don't know, stealing horses, right? That's something that clearly did not happen, right? And they were convicted of it. And it looks like there's going to be an overturning of whether or not this statute is the right one for these conditions. Should they be held because they just did something wrong and it may not have been that thing? No, that's not the way our system works.
But when you have pictures of people who are breaking windows and, mm-hmm. and going in and going over stanchions and hopping over security, I mean, something's happening there.
Oh, yeah. But these guys were not charged with the breaking windows. They weren't charged with violence. They were charged with something else. And if that something else is not the right thing, should they be serving time when they haven't been convicted of the other things?
Maybe the point is that we need better laws about the theft
of
services, of bribery. It seems wrong that even if you were just part of the mob, if you became part of that force that pushed through the Capitol, maybe it's involuntary, or people get
it's not to say they're not guilty of something, but they have to be charged with the thing that they're guilty of.
We've got the tapes. I don't know. It seems like we could prove that. But all right, we have to take end. We're late. My thanks to the whole group. Thank you so much, as always, for being wonderful. We'll be back right after this.